and speaking on my new book. It has been 10 years since Governing by Network came out and translated into Italian about 5 years ago, and we did a number of nice events here, and I'm happy to report that our new book is four chapters into being translated into Italian right now, and so it's a race between Spanish and Italian of which will be the first language it's translated into. So I'm voting for Italian, okay? So I want to talk a bit about how things have changed very, very dramatically since we wrote Governing by Network. And everything that I heard earlier was absolutely right on. We've now spoken on the book in 10 countries to over 5,000 public officials and business people and entrepreneurs just in the last 6 months alone. And the landscape is rapidly, rapidly evolving in this area when you think about social innovation and public administration. So you have governments facing massive fiscal challenges both here in Italy, in the United States, everywhere really around the world. And so facing these challenges and at the same time citizen demands going up, it's simply impossible for governments to meet all those demands. You've also have citizens expecting more. Citizen demands are really insatiable. When you have 24/7 service that you get in the private sector and everything that we're used to getting on an app, our expectations have increased. Fortunately, we also have the universe of problem solvers is growing exponentially. And I'm going to talk a lot about that. This is social entrepreneurs, it's foundations, it's nonprofits, it's the fourth sector. It's the sharing economy. It's citizen-to-citizen, citizen co-designing services. This has grown dramatically in the last 10 years since we wrote the book. One reason is technology. Technology is creating a supply shock. And what that means is by technology is rapidly bringing down the costs of starting an organization, of contributing to societal solutions, scaling an organization, but also of connecting millions of people together. And oftentimes, government was always the intermediary, and what we're seeing more and more is government's not the intermediary anymore because the citizens can connect directly using technology. So that's playing a big role, and that's one of the big reasons why what's happening today is very different than even 10 years ago. Talent. I've spoken now in front of over 1,000 business school students in the last 6 months at some of the best business schools in the world at MIT Sloan and Harvard and Stanford and Yale and in Australia and the UK. And I ask all of these business school students, how many of you want to go into something where you have doing social good, where you have a purpose, a social purpose? 85% of them raise their hand. And that changes the game when you have some of the best talent that's trying to get into the societal problem-solving arena. That simply wasn't happening 10, 15 years ago. Then you have businesses looking beyond the bottom line. They're looking at their social impact, their environmental impact. And you have markets that are evolving now where you've got people who are buying social impact and at governments, foundations, and others, but also sellers of solutions. And I'm going to get into that. So the landscape has changed dramatically. And what it means is that as government officials, you're no longer the only game in town in terms of solving problems and delivering services. There's a rapid growth on the supply side. So what I want to do is take you through a few big problems the world is facing and talk about new ways of solving those problems based on those developments that I talked about. The first is recycling. The world produces more than 3.5 million tons of solid waste per day. 75% of it is recyclable, but most of it is not recycled. A colleague of mine a few years ago named Ron Gonin decided he wanted to try to solve that problem. He didn't know a lot about recycling, but he had a passion for the environment, and he had a lot of business savvy. So he left Deloitte, and he went to work. He went to Columbia Business School to develop his business model. And what Ron's goal was to take America's recycling rates, which had stagnated at about 33%, and bring them closer to Denmark's world-leading 70% recycling. And what he decided to do this, his insight was that we needed to change the lens about how we think about recycling. We needed to move from cajoling people to recycle and public service announcements to making recycling fun, actually making it a game. And so we came up with this idea to put RFID tags or sensors on recycling bins. And so for every pound of recyclables you put in, you would actually get points. And you could, and because of the sensors, they knew how much you were actually recycling. And they signed up a lot of businesses who would then, where you could redeem those points for real goods and services. And he also knew that people respond to incentives and they're competitive, so you could actually go online and see how much you're recycling versus your neighbors. So when Ron first came up with this idea, he was a young guy in his 20s, going around to governments to help figure it out, and a lot of people were saying, nice idea, Ron, but we don't think you can pull it off. There's a lot of doubters. But finally he found a city that was willing to try this out, and that was his hometown of Philadelphia. Now, the fortunate thing for him was Philadelphia had some of the lowest recycle rates in the country at 7%, so they could only go up. So he tried out this system, and he got a lot of Philadelphians involved in signing up for this Recycle Bank exchange. And very soon, recycling rates went from 20% upwards of 90% in some neighborhoods. And from there, Recycle Bank is now in hundreds of cities around the world where they're using this system of gamification and using technology and incentives to transform recycling. What this is an example of, and what we pointed out a lot in the book, is looking at an old problem with new eyes and coming up with a whole new way of solving that problem using today's technologies, using new business models, and using citizens themselves. If you think about recycling in this case, that's the biggest example of citizen co-design and citizen self-service, because they're actually having to take the recycles out to the curb themselves. So let's look at some of the innovations here. You had prizes and challenges, which we're seeing a lot of, that they offered actual rewards, citizen action, and that citizens competing with each other, real outcomes, that disruptive technologies in terms of the sensors and social media that was used, and they used gamification. And we see that a lot when you're trying to change behavior now. The use of behavioral insights and gamification, and many of these new models are using that. So that's one example. Let's look at, and some of the results have been fantastic, 4,000 partners, 4 million members of the Recycle Bank community. The next example I want to look at is clean water. 1.1 billion people worldwide lack access to clean water. Now, this gentleman is named Dean Kamen. Dean Kamen is a famous inventor, and he invented something called the Segway, right? He was the inventor of the Segway. And he also then wanted to invent something to solve the clean water problem. And so he developed this water purifier called the Slingshot. I'm going to let you listen to Dean tell one of our leading news comedian, Stephen Colbert, a little bit more about what he was trying to accomplish.
That box has no membranes, no disposables of any kind. You can stick one hose that comes out of it, which I'll show you, into any source of water.
So this thing right here, this is the dirty water?
That's dirty
over
water.
Here.
You stick a hose into anything that looks wet anywhere in the world. A puddle.
The ocean.
The ocean. A chemical waste site.
A 50-gallon drum of urine.
A 50-gallon drum of urine.
Okay.
And it comes through this machine, and it comes out here as perfect, distilled, clean
water. But how does it get, I mean, like, so out of here, I can put anything in there?
You can put anything
in there. I could put, like, heavy metals.
Heavy metals, hexavalent chrome.
Poison. What do you want to do with this?
Well, since 1.1 billion people, 20% of the world's population, goes to bed every night sick or thirsty because they don't have access to water, clean water, we thought we'd put these in production, figure out how to get them placed around the world, and we'd wipe out 50% of human disease.
So you're saying nothing can make it from there to there. No substance put in there except the water will actually end up in the water over there.
That's correct.
I'm going to put that to the test right now. Okay, hold on.
Let me help you.
All right. I guarantee you that water's going to be sweet, spicy, and chili flavored.
So here's the situation. You have a famous inventor who is trying to provide a solution for water scarcity in parts of the world where water is very scarce. So you'd think it would be a slam dunk for him to find someone to partner with. And in fact, the slingshot can even run on cow manure. Okay? Yet, Kamen went to the United Nations. He went to big non-governmental organizations, NGOs. He went to the World Bank. He went to governments. And he pitched the idea. No one was interested. They weren't interested in it at all. So Kamen had to rethink and change his lens about who he might be able to partner with to take the slingshot all throughout the world. Now, he had to find an organization that was in everywhere around the world, even in the tiniest villages in Africa and India, who also had an economic interest in clean water. And it suddenly hit him. Who is it, do you think? Yes, someone said it. Coca-Cola. If any of you have been to small villages in India and Africa, the one thing you can always find is Coca-Cola from a Western perspective. That's because they have an amazing distribution system. And Coca-Cola, water, is one of the main ingredients in Coke. And they actually cannot make Coke, of course, without clean water. So he pitched the idea to Coke. It fit in with their Safe Water for Africa campaign. They've joined together now, and they're putting the slingshots in 20 different countries throughout the developing world in these kiosks that they're also supplying with wireless technology. And this is an example of this kind of unlikely partnerships that we're seeing a lot of in today's world, where they found a mutual advantage, a social sort of thing that Dean Kamen wanted to do, an economic advantage for Coke that also fit within their corporate social responsibility campaign. Now, Kamen, Coca-Cola, Ron Gonin, Recycle Bank are what we call wave makers. They're organizations or individuals that are trying to revolutionize how we approach thorny challenges. And they're taking on challenges that historically have been the province of government. But government, as I've said, has been stretched too thin in many respects. And it's just very apparent that government can't handle all these challenges by itself anymore. And so what we have is these wave makers who are closing the gap between what citizens are expecting and what government budgets will actually provide. And these include a wide variety of organizations. They include the big foundations, like the Gates Foundation and Omidyar Network. They include impact investors, and these are venture philanthropists who are investing in social impact, which has become a multi-billion dollar industry now. We're creating capital markets around social outcomes. They include lots of companies that are now trying to get much more into solving societal problems while making a profit. Conveners like the World Economic Forum, and innovators. And what we see now is this huge growth of social innovators and social enterprises. By last estimate, there's 2 million of them in Europe alone. 2 million. And those are mostly organizations, who are either nonprofit or for-profit. Many of them are for-profit. But the for-profit ones are trying to solve problems, deep social problems. And it's not just in the West, it's all over the world. I was in India a month ago. India has some of the most active organizations like this in the world because their problems are so deep. And they realize government won't be able to solve them in India. So the government's trying to facilitate this. But India has 18 investment funds right now devoted to social innovation. 18 alone. And more sophisticated financial market around it. Now, this all comes together in what we call the solution economy. It's an actual economy that we believe is operating around solving societal problems. Because I think what we've done is we've moved from kind of these networks oftentimes, and now what we're seeing is many of these social entrepreneurs and businesses and governments are actually trying to create markets around market failure or around government failure. And so with this, you have wage makers we've talked about. They're trying to solve problems, oftentimes using disruptive technologies, like we've heard. And they use those technologies to create business models that can scale and scale very, very rapidly, much faster than a typical nonprofit or community organization. They're built from the beginning to scale to thousands of people, or some of the enterprises I visited in India, they were built to scale to millions and tens of millions of people. And then they're using what we call impact currencies. And those are things like carbon credits, or the fact that social impact itself has become a form of currency because people will pay for that. And they're transacting on public value exchanges where that you get the buyers and the sellers of these markets entering. And it all comes together in these solution ecosystems. You can call them ecosystems, you can call them networks, but this is where the problems are being solved today. We've mapped out more than 36 of these ecosystems all over the world. And just to give you an idea of how this is working, I'm going to show you two around unlikely areas. So think about food waste. In the West right now, food waste is, we waste so much food. In the U.S. alone, 40% of all food is wasted at either the distribution level or in people's homes or restaurants. It costs $160 billion. So I didn't think much about food waste throughout most of my life, but there's a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of companies that have, and they're forming these ecosystems around food waste prevention, food waste rescue, food waste distribution. In Europe, there's over 1,000 social supermarkets where they rescue food from traditional supermarkets, they put them in there, and they're 70-80% less, and they're used for low-income people. And the interesting thing about all this is that these are all market opportunities for people who are seeing opportunities for solving a problem, but also creating niche markets. Now, people will say, well, I can see how markets can work around areas like that because there's an economic incentive. But what about solving a problem like human trafficking, which is such a big issue right now, where we have slavery in the West and in the developing world? Well, that's another area where you can see these ecosystems working. When you have service providers who are providing things, you have a lot of nonprofits who are working to do this, and you also have a lot of companies who have pledged to remove all human trafficking from their supply chain. There's only so much government can do in this area, so it takes this kind of very complex intersections of a lot of these organizations to get behind it, to fight, which is a very powerful ecosystem. So I want to spend a few minutes on business models that scale and also follow up on what we heard about kind of citizens and co-design. The business model innovation is one of the really interesting areas around societal problem solving. And one of them is, again, using citizens themselves. So you know when you go on a website and you see those squiggly lines and they ask you to authenticate yourself and to type those letters in to prove you are who you are. How many of you have done that before? Raise your hand. So that's called reCAPTCHA. And every time you do that, you are helping to digitize a book or a manuscript. I bet most of you didn't know that, right? But thank you for doing that. 800 million people in the world, 10% of the world's population, is helping to digitize old books and manuscripts by typing in those letters because the computer couldn't read them. The guy who came up with this model is named Louis von Ahn. He's a scientist at Carnegie Mellon University, and he tries to figure out ways of solving really tough problems that would have cost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to do, but to do it for free by using citizens themselves. So he came up with another idea. He said, so much of the web is only in a few languages. It's in English and maybe Chinese and a few other. How can he translate the web into six other languages, websites? So he came up with an idea called Duolingo. Duolingo, basically, you sign up to learn this foreign language. Some of you are nodding, you've tried it maybe. And you sign up to do it, and as you are typing out, you know, the word in English or in Italian or something, you are actually helping to translate that website into another language. And then they can judge the accuracy of it by having a lot of people do it and coming up with the same thing. 4 million people now are learning a foreign language and at the same time doing the work of translating these websites, and it's all for free. It's the most popular foreign language class in the world today, and it just started a few years ago. So how does government take advantage of this, you know, these great sort of ideas? Well, the city of Boston came up with an idea. They said, we've got a lot of problems of potholes and graffiti and public works issues. How can the citizens help us to fix those? So they have an app, which is called Boston Citizen Connect. You download the app, and when you see a pothole, you see graffiti, you just take a picture and you press send, and it knows where you are at the time because of GPS, and that immediately goes into the city's work order system. 20% of all the public work orders now from the city of Boston come from citizens themselves. So citizens, they've outsourced the kind of job of finding potholes and graffiti to citizens because citizens are everywhere, and they have an interest in letting government know about that. So it works so well, they came up with another idea called Street Bump. So what you do is you download the app, and then you just put your cell phone down in your car, and as you go over bumpy roads, it will transmit that information back to the city's public works department, and they can tell where the roads are smooth and where they're bumpy from citizens. It's pretty ingenious. Now, so speaking of roads, another big issue that we see in many parts of the world is traffic congestion. I know you don't have that problem in Italy at all, but we certainly see it in the U.S. And let's look at the traditional way of solving kind of traffic congestion. You know, you can build subway extensions or new roads, right? But when you build new roads, just more cars get on it. New buses. Or I was just in New Zealand 2 months ago, and this was one of the solutions that they'd come up with, jetpacks. But believe it or not, there's a company in New Zealand called Martin Aircraft, which will be putting jetpacks on production, commercial production, next year. You need a pilot's license to actually drive one, and it's at about $300,000 per jetpack. I don't think it's going to solve the congestion problem. So what about another solution, a lightweight solution to this that might not cost government anything? Can anyone think of an idea, a way to do that, to start reducing traffic congestion at almost no cost to government? I heard some of them. The cell phone. Now, how do you do that? Well, the cell phone is a way of connecting us to other citizens, right? And also providing information that we previously didn't know. So there's a whole variety of things going on. There's ride sharing. There's car sharing. I do all of these because I don't actually have a car. Bike sharing. Integrated fare management, real-time traffic. I have something called Waze, where when I'm in a car, I find out where the congestion is or not by they're following me, and I can follow other people. And all of these things, and we estimated that simply doubling ride sharing in a city, doubling it, which in the U.S. gets us just back to the 1970s, is the equivalent in traffic congestion relief of spending $27 billion on public transit, and at almost no cost. But how many governments are actually doing a lot to try to encourage this? Not enough. Now, the other thing I love is the parking apps. Have any of you tried this? This is how I end up having to park in D.C. a lot. This looks kind of like Italian parking, too, to me. And in San Francisco, you go there, and there's an app that will tell you all the open parking spaces in the city, so you don't have to drive around for it. So what the cell phone has done is it can help solve the traffic information problem. And there's hundreds of of entrepreneurs who are coming up with these solutions and connecting citizens to each other. Because the biggest waste in transportation is single vehicle occupancy cars where there's empty seats. So you can reduce that, the waste in transportation, just like we're trying to reduce the waste in food. So what about government? What about your role? How can government support social innovation and support all this? What is government's role in this world? Well, here are a few ideas. First of all, funding it. We see a lot of governments, the government of the UK is their $1 billion big society capital fund. The government of Alberta just announced $1 billion social innovation fund. There's a $500 million one in the US. USAID and DFID have a number of these funds. I was just in India, and they have one that's $100 million that they want to get to $1 billion. So government playing the role almost of kind of helping to fund this innovation, because these are organizations providing public value. Secondly, legal and institution building. Is it our hybrid organizations legal here, where they're both providing first and foremost a social good, but they're also for profit? Do they have legal protection against shareholders? Do you have social stock exchanges like we see in Johannesburg? How can you create the institutions for this to happen? The UK government has done a lot along these lines. Third, open up and transform procurement. Your government dollars you are the major buyer in most of these areas: healthcare, education, transportation. How you spend those dollars can play a big role. You can either spend them in a traditional way, or you could start diverting some of them to these more disruptive approaches that are cheaper and oftentimes better. So the government and your procurement processes do need to change, though, because this is a very different world than we've seen before. Open data, as we talked about in open government, there are 1 million open government data sets around the world today. 1 million. You know how many there were about 5 years ago? There's about zero. Very, very few. And a lot of governments are essentially taking this open, a lot of companies are using open data to create businesses. And so thinking about data as a currency, and how do you get your data going? Lastly, I would say this thing called social pay for success initiatives. There's 65 in the US and the UK now. We've just seen some in Australia, New Zealand. Every day we're seeing new governments. And that's where governments are saying, we're going to move away from just paying regular contracts. We're going to pay according to who is successful in social impact bonds and others. And so one example is around crime. Governments in the US, the UK, Australia have said, we're not going to just pay to lock people up in these cases. We're going to pay according to how you're able to rehabilitate the prisoners. And if they go back into jail again, you're going to be penalized, and you're not going to get all the money, and we're going to pay after the fact, after they don't go back into jail. Those are called pay-for-success initiatives. They open up the government marketplace to lots of new providers. Let me end with one story. You don't need to be a CEO of a company or a big foundation or a senior government official to be part of this solution revolution. Every individual has an opportunity, and I hope the examples I gave you showed you that. And so let me end with one other big problem, and that is bees. How many of you know that in large parts of Europe and North America, honeybees are becoming extinct? How many of you knew that? Not very many, a few. Well, they are. So it's a really big problem. So as government officials, what do you do about the honeybee problem? Do you create a commission of honeybee survival? Do you hire tens of thousands of government honeybee keepers? No. It's a tough issue, but How do you deal with it? Well, maybe what you do is you find someone like Oliver Maxwell. Oliver Maxwell is a serial social entrepreneur. He lives in Copenhagen, but he's a Brit. And one day he was driving around the city and he came upon a honeybee keeper who told him the story that in Copenhagen they were absolutely running out of bees. And what a problem that is from an environmental and from their food supply. And he said, no one is doing anything about it. And of course, you need beekeepers for honeybee survival in cities. And so what Maxwell did was he said, you know what, I'm going to look into this. I'm a social entrepreneur. I know how to fix problems. I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to find out. He looked into it, and he found out that what was happening was that all the pieces were there to fix the problem, all the elements of the ecosystem, but no one had put them all together. So he went to companies, and he said, you know what? If you give us your rooftop to put beehives on there, we will give you the ability to make your own brand of honey that you can give out to your workers and others. He actually, Deloitte, we have an office in Copenhagen, and we now have Deloitte honey, from the beehives. And then he went to the aging beekeeper workforce, and he said, would you train people if I'm able to source you new beekeepers? He went to the city, and he said, I need a little bit of startup capital for this. Will you do it? And then he went to the labor organizations, the homelessness organizations, and he said, will you give me people that we can train? And they got unemployed people, they got some homeless people and others that became trained by the beekeepers. And what Maxwell provided was the honey and the beehives. And it's no longer a problem in Copenhagen. His company, BB, is everywhere. They're on the rooftops, and they've been able to fix the problem. One guy put together this whole ecosystem, and he took a very sticky situation, and he fixed it with Numi. So thank you very much. I look forward to the rest of the presentations. And grazie a tutti. Okay?